All right, we are picking up again in our study on the life of David. We're coming to the end of one of the books of the Bible that contain the information of David's life, and we're beginning the next book of the Bible that picks up his story and continues it. There's a reason, of course, why David's life story is split between two books of the Bible. It's kind of unusual in that regard. It's because David's life is really split into two sections or two portions. There is the portion that is dedicated in the book of 1 Samuel to all of the preparatory work that the Lord did in David's life and in his heart to prepare him for his great calling, which is to be king of Israel. And then, of course, the book of 2 Samuel continues with the transition point, the critical transition point, which we'll be studying today, in which David becomes king, and then from that point forward actually carries on in his new and fulfilled role as king of over Israel. So the transition point, of course, has to do with the death of Saul, who is still the king of Israel at this moment in David's story. We've got a lot of material to cover today, so I want to get right to it. I don't know for sure that I'll be able to cover all of it, but what I would like to do is cover these two chapters together because they really do belong together. So we're at the very last chapter of 1 Samuel, that's chapter 31, and the first chapter, of course, of 2 Samuel chapter 1. So let me just read to start. I'll read all of chapter 31, and then I'll pause. We'll talk about chapter 31 for a few minutes. And then we'll see where we're at time-wise, and we may go on and accomplish chapter 1 of 2 Samuel as well. All right, so 1 Samuel 31. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines struck down Jonathan and Abinadab, and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. The battle pressed hard against Saul, and the archers found him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and mistreat me." But his armor-bearer would not, for he feared greatly. Therefore Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. And when his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died with him. Thus Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor-bearer, and all his men on the same day together. And when the men of Israel, who were on the other side of the valley, and those beyond the Jordan, saw that the men of Israel had fled, and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned their cities and fled, and the Philistines came and lived in them. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. So they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. They put his armor in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. But when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and went all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan. And they came to Jabesh and burned them there. And they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree in Jabesh and fasted 7 days. All right, in our story, where we're at is David, of course, has been for the last segment of his life, he's been among the Philistines. He had fled out of fear of Saul to the land of the Philistines and had ingratiated himself to the king of the Philistines and had been serving the king of the Philistines from Ziklag, a town that the Philistine king had given him to live in along with his 600 men. And while he was there, the Philistines decided their hearts were stirred to do battle with Israel. Remember, we recently studied that the king of the Philistines had wanted David to go with him into battle, to be by his side against his own countrymen, against Israel and against Saul. He assumed that David would want to do that because he knew that Saul was David's enemy and David was there, you know, fleeing from Saul. And while David was obligated to help the king, we saw that the Lord sovereignly, providentially, graciously, mercifully intervened on David's behalf and stirred up the other leaders of the Philistines so that David was not trusted by them. And therefore, the king sent David back to Ziklag while the Philistines were going to go ahead and battle with the Israelites. Now, David went back to Ziklag, and when he got there, of course, remember, he discovered, as we saw, that the Amalekites had raided his own city, his own home, and had carried away captive all of their families and had burned their city. We saw that this was the Lord's discipline in David's life for having gone to the Philistines, not in faith, but in fear of Saul, but that the Lord was gracious even in his discipline. Thankfully, you know, we've experienced this ourselves. Every one of us deserves the discipline of the Lord and regularly needs the Lord's discipline. Nevertheless, the Lord is often gracious and merciful to us in his discipline. And so the Lord led David and his men to be able to recover all that they had lost as they chased down the Amalekite raiders. But all of that was taking place now while the Philistines continued on in their intention to attack the Israelites and to do battle with them. So the battle we see now in chapter 31 is actually in the chronology, in the timing of the events, taking place at the exact same time that David is now returning home to Ziklag and then chasing down the Amalekites to recover their families. And so while David is elsewhere, by the direction of the Lord, we'll see this is a gracious working of God as well, a providential working of God. Nevertheless, what's going on is Israel now is at war with the Philistines, and the battle does not go well. Up until this time in Israel's history, every major battle that they've been engaged in, for the most part, they have come out victorious because not so much Israel was better fighters, stronger, more numerous, but because they've lived as a nation under the blessing of God, and the Lord has poured out his blessing even to the extent of making them victorious in the various battles that they've encountered as a nation. Not this time. This time they go to battle, they're under the direction of Saul, and it's a devastating defeat. A complete and utter defeat on the battlefield, and in particular at the focal point of the battle, Mount Gilboa. We see Saul making his personal last stand on Mount Gilboa as the battle presses hard against him. And he's, in essence, surrounded by the Philistines, and he's mortally wounded by their archers. Mortal wound being one that he's not going to walk off the battlefield from the wound by these archers, and yet he's still alive. And Saul, in his circumstance, of course, is in a situation where he is afraid of something. And it's not so much that he's afraid to die, as we see by the choices that he makes in this circumstance. He is afraid of something happening to him that's outside of his control. What is it that he's really fearing in this situation? Not so much fearing death, but fearing abuse and dishonor. He's fearing for his body to be taken and abused, which was a commonly done thing by victorious armies, taking the bodies of the leaders of the armies that they conquer, and then using the bodies of those leaders to make a statement to their own people about their dominance in the battle, their victory in the battle. And, of course, at the end of the story here in this chapter, we see that his fears were well-founded, because the next day, after the events of the battle, after Saul actually dies, the Philistines go back to the battlefield specifically to look for Saul. and to look for his sons. And they find him, and they do abuse his body, and they take his body and his armor and his weapons, and they use them for their own purposes, as we'll talk about in just a moment. But here he is, mortally wounded on the battlefield by the arrows of the enemy, and he is not going to walk off the battlefield, and yet he wants to die on his own terms. And so in his desire to die on his own terms, he turns to the one person that's with him in this moment. There's only two men left alive on Mount Gilboa. That's Saul and his armor bearer. And there is kind of a subtle interplay going on here that would force us to remember back to an earlier time in Saul's story. The very first time we're introduced to Saul's armor bearer, and that, we're not talking about this same individual, but we're talking about the same role, the role of the armor bearer of the king, which was a very close and important role in the life of a king. The man who stood by his side had to be a trusted man, a man who would literally care for the king's armor to make sure his weapons were in good repair, his armor was in good repair. It wasn't just like a butler that would put the armor on the king just before the battle. It was a man who was trusted to keep those weapons and those armors in condition that was ready to fight, ready to go to war. The first time that we're introduced to Saul's armor bearer, does anybody remember earlier in the story of Saul who that would be? David was Saul's original armor bearer, remember. This was after the early events when Saul and David first encountered each other, and Saul, you know, found some qualities in David that he appreciated, and he actually took David from his father's household and from watching his father's flock. And this was, as we were studying David's life, we saw this was one of the very first jumps in responsibility that the Lord gave to David in the beginning of a preparatory phase to prepare him for the responsibility of kingship, to make him the right-hand man, the armor bearer, the personal servant of the king himself, to be able to see up front and close and personal how a king does the business of kingship. And so here we have kind of like the other side of that coin, in which Saul in his most desperate moment is leaning upon his armor bearer in a particular way, and that is that out of fear of abuse by the Philistines, he calls to his armor bearer and gives him an order. This is a command of a king. This isn't a request of a friend to a friend at a key moment in the battle or at his last moment in life. He is, as king, giving one final command, one final order to a man in his army. And as king, he has every right to expect full and complete obedience to his orders. But what happens here is Saul gives one last order to his armor bearer, and that is, I want you to run me through with your sword. I want you to end my life. And of course, the armor bearer, it says, fears greatly. And we're not told exactly what he was afraid of. We're not given any background as to exactly what he was thinking. It won't be until the next chapter when we hear the story of an Amalekite as he encounters David and as he tells an account of Saul's final minutes that we understand what it is most likely that Saul's armor bearer feared. And that was, he feared to kill the Lord's anointed. Now, we know that Saul is not in a good place with the Lord at this point in his life. He hasn't been in a good place with the Lord for years. He's been pursuing David. David's just come. This is the very tail end of a seven-year period of David fleeing from Saul in the wilderness. This is the tail end of an extended period of time in which Saul has been in a disconnected relationship with the Lord and has been, you know, moving in and out of insanity with moments of clarity and periods, though, where he was acting illogically and unrighteously. And here in this last moment, we see that Saul commands his armor bearer to run me through, and the armor bearer fears to touch him because he's the Lord's anointed, not because he at this present moment deserves the anointing of the Lord, but there was a moment in Saul's life when Samuel the prophet, by the direction of the Lord, under the blessing of the Lord, took a horn of oil, symbolizing the Spirit of God and the fullness of God's blessing, poured it out over Saul's head and anointed him as king over Israel. And so the armor bearer knows better than to slay the anointed of the Lord, even though that man is asking him to do that very thing and even commanding him as his commanding officer to do that very thing. Nevertheless, he's afraid to do so. And the armor bearer is righteous in his refusal to kill Saul in this moment. And yet what we see here is this is an evidence of layers of what we could call God's judgment upon his final judgment upon Saul. Saul has been in rebellion against the Lord for years now, and because he has not been listening to the Lord, the very final thing that happens in Saul's life is Saul is giving commands expecting to be heard and obeyed, and his armor bearer refuses to listen and refuses to obey him. And it's like the Lord is still at the last minute of this rebellious man's life. He's using the circumstances of his life to teach him the lesson that if you will not listen to me, I will make it that no one will listen to you. The man refuses to hear his commanding officer, refuses to obey, refuses to kill Saul. So here it's kind of like a stalemate. Saul is mortally wounded. He can't escape. His armor bearer is with him, but he will not obey him. And now all he can do is wait for the Philistines to come and abuse him and to mistreat him and to slay him. And so he does not want that to happen. He doesn't want to be alive and awake to see that happen. And so he makes a fatal decision. And his fatal decision is to take his own sword and to fall on his sword. Now, what does that mean, fall on his sword? It means literally to take your sword in such a way to where you're going to fall on the ground and with the sword's hilt against the ground for stability, you're going to kill yourself with your own sword. And so Saul makes a fatal decision to what we commonly call commit suicide at his very last moment. So Saul's last decision in life is a decision to end his own life. And this is also an evidence of God's final judgment upon this rebellious king. There are a handful throughout the Bible of suicides that are identified for us. But in every single case, without exception, it's an indicator of a man who has previously been disconnected from his relationship from the Lord, and in his rebellion and in his self-deception, chooses the final and ultimate evidence of an unrighteous and darkened and deceived heart by ending his own life unrighteously. Probably the most famous suicide in the Bible is, anybody remember? Judas, of course. Hanging himself as the final indicator of how completely disconnected he had become to Jesus, you know, having enjoyed 3 previous years of fellowship with him and service alongside him, becoming so completely disobedient, deceived, and disconnected that he ends his life, and tragically so. Clearly, a final judgment indicating the darkened and sinful condition of his heart. So Saul is in this same place. He commits suicide, and this again indicates the Lord's final judgment upon his life. The lesson here, and this is a lesson from every one of the key figures that are identified for us throughout the Bible. We're talking about, you know, from Abraham through, you know, Jacob, Isaac, through Moses, you know, through of course, you know, we're up to Saul and David here, and all of the key figures beyond this. How a man's life ends is an indicator of where that person's heart is in their relationship with the Lord. How our life ends matters. You know, it's important, as you can imagine, how we start our walk with the Lord. It's critically important how we continue our walk with the Lord, but it's even more important how we end with the Lord. There are so many that seemingly start well, or even beyond that, continue well for a period of time, but not all end well. And Saul is certainly in that category. He began well. He really did. When you go back and read, we haven't focused in our study on David a lot of attention on the beginning of Saul's relationship with the Lord. But it's a good beginning. But he wasn't able to continue forward in his walk with the Lord in the same way that he began. And he ends almost exactly the opposite from where he started. And so he ends, his life ends as a fallen, defeated, and dishonored king. There's no good thing about Saul's death in the way that he dies. Israel is diminished when Saul dies. One of the details given to us in this battle is that as Saul dies, all of the cities on the border of the land between the Israelites and the Philistines are evacuated by the Israelites. And the Philistines move in and take possession of their cities. What we see going on there is that's exactly the reverse of what we saw in the conquest of the Promised Land earlier in an earlier generation under the leadership of Joshua, as the Lord led the children of Israel into the Promised Land, and they conquered the peoples of those cities and took possession of their lands and their homes as an evidence of God's great blessing upon them. Now we see exactly the opposite taking place. They're retreating from those cities, and the uncircumcised Philistines are taking possession of their land. And so as the king dies in rebellion and disobedience, the entire nation is diminished. But even worse than that, what's diminished ultimately is the name of the Lord. The name of the Lord is diminished in the eyes of the entire Philistine nation. They take Saul, they take his body, they behead him, they take his strip, they strip the armor from his body, and they nail his body to the wall of one of their cities for public humiliation and dishonor. And then they take his weapons and they take his armor and they place them where? In one of the temples to one of their gods. And what's going on here is they are testifying essentially that their God is greater than Yahweh, the God of Israel. That their God has given them victory over Yahweh. And the defeat of Saul and the defeat of the armies of Israel, and then the trophies of war, Saul's armor and his weapons, are a testimony that the Lord is less than their God, that they are honoring by placing those weapons in their temple. It's, again, the reverse of a pattern we saw earlier. Remember when David had entered in by the providence of God, that day that he showed up at the battlefield, and it was an earlier battle, with Saul as the leader of the people of Israel, the armies of Israel, and they were facing the armies of the Philistines. And David wasn't anyone significant at that moment in his personal history. He was just sent by his father to bring supplies from home for his brother and the other brother that was with him in the battle. And as he's there, he hears the sounds of the Philistines mocking the Israelites, and he goes to find out what's going on, and he discovers that the Philistines have a champion, and that their champion is calling for the champion of Israel, and no one, including Saul, has the courage to go out and face this Philistine champion. And we, you know, are well familiar with the story of how David responds with faith and with courage, and he goes out and he faces this giant of a man, Goliath. And by God's blessing and grace, he faces this giant who comes with full armament. this huge stature, and he faces him only with the sling and the five smooth stones. Using only one of the five, slings the first stone with a perfect shot, hits him in the middle of the forehead, slays the giant with the very first shot. And when he slays the giant, what happens next? He takes his own sword and cuts his head off, exactly what they do to Saul, who is at this moment the champion of Israel. And he not only takes the head of the giant, he then takes the sword, and then the next time we see the sword, it's not strapped to David's side. The next time we see the sword in the story of David, and this goes back quite a ways in our earlier studies, we see that when David first fled his home from Saul, who was trying to capture David to kill him, he flees first to the tabernacle of the Lord, and he interacts with the priest there, and he receives bread for sustenance from the holy bread that was offered in the tabernacle, the bread of presence that was offered up, and he receives something else, remember, from the priest, the sword of Goliath, which was stored in the tabernacle of the Lord. Now, what we see going on here with the Philistines is the exact flip side of that. They take Saul's armor and they take Saul's weapons and they place them in their temple. Just like the sword of Goliath was in the tabernacle of the Lord, was a testimony to the superiority of Yahweh over all the gods of the Philistines, now the Philistines are basically celebrating that their God is superior to Yahweh after all. And of course, we know that's not true, and that's ultimately not true even as the events of the story continue to unfold under David's leadership. But that's the real tragedy of what's going on here with Saul, and that's, I think, what we're meant to see as men of God, which is that our obedience or our disobedience has a greater impact than just our own personal life circumstances. So as we obey the Lord, what happens is the Lord causes his blessing to not just fill our personal cup, our life, he causes his blessing to overflow our lives and then have an effect on the community around us in such a way that it brings glory and honor to the name of the Lord. If we live in disobedience and rebellion, then God fills our personal cup with his judgment and his discipline in such a way that it overflows our cup and it spills out to the community in such a way that it actually diminishes not our own personal lives only, not our own personal reputations only, but ultimately diminishes his purpose for his kingdom, the children of Israel losing cities on the borderland, and ultimately diminishes the reputation and the name of the Lord himself in the eyes of the community. I mean, how many, I was thinking, you know, Saul was the most famous man in Israel at this moment in history, the most famous man. And he was in disobedience and rebellion, and his fall led to the dishonoring of the name of the Lord. What impact has it had when famous believers, famous Christians, fall in sin? I was thinking back a few years ago when Jimmy Swaggart, for instance, who was at that time one of the most famous Christians in America, was on something like 600 and some odd radio stations, when it was discovered that he was participating in secret sin behind the scenes, what kind of an impact did that have when the nation learned of his compromise? And, you know, those that do not love the Lord, you know, took that news and used it as a means to celebrate and rejoice in a perverse sense, you know, and diminished and dishonored the name of the Lord because they were able to say, look at how this hypocrite has been saying one thing and doing another. And it took years after that for the reputation of the name of the Lord and the gospel to be rebuilt in the perspective of those that were affected by that. The example of Jim Baker from the PTL club before that, and you know, we could go back, and there are many others who are at one point famous and well-known figures who who fell in disobedience and sin, who were connected to the name of the Lord, who were associated with the name of the Lord, but whose private sin and rebellion led to a dishonoring of the name of the Lord. And so we see this, what you can only call a tragic event in the fall of Saul. It's not just there's a battle and the king dies and one team wins and the other team loses. This is more than just, you know, horizontal human level natural teams competing here, natural armies competing. This is the reputation of the Lord in the eyes of a darkened and unbelieving world that's at stake. But there is one kind of parentheses of honor that's going on in the midst of this circumstance, and that's what we see at the very end of chapter 31. And that's the response of one group of men, the men of Jabesh-Gilead. It's an interesting story what goes on here. In the ancient world, when a king fell in battle, it was the responsibility of anyone that was still alive in his army to protect at all costs, not just the king's life, but when the king died, to protect his body and to take that body and to bring it back and to give it its proper rights in the final disposition of that body. But in Saul's army, the defeat was so devastating, all of his men were killed in battle. There was no one to protect the king, no one to protect his body. And so as a result, the Philistines came and abused it, as we've discussed. So the men of Jabesh-Gilead, who aren't too far away, 15 miles approximately, away from the location of where Saul's body is nailed naked to the walls of the city of Bethshan. And they hear the report of how his body is being abused in that way. And they rise up at night, the valiant men of the city, and they travel all night long, walking 15 miles, crossing a river and going into enemy territory. And they retake the body of Saul. They bring it back and they dispose of the body in a more honorable manner. And the question is, why would this one city of men act in this more honorable way? For the sake of your notes, for our time, we won't have time to go back and read the events. But back in chapter 11 of this same book, this is before we really get engaged in David's life. But Saul had done a great favor for the men of Jabesh-Gilead. In essence, what had taken place is these men had been surrounded. This city had been surrounded by another king. And the king had laid siege to their city. And they were just ready to be conquered. And they tried to negotiate a truce with the king that had surrounded them. And the king said, I will give you a truce on one condition, that you open the gates of the city, you surrender to me, and when you do, this is what I'm going to do to all of the men of the city. I'm going to gouge out the right eye of every man in this city to just demonstrate my dominance over you. But at least you'll preserve your life that way. I won't kill you. I'm just going to gouge out your right eye. How's that for an offer? And of course, you know, the men of the city in their great fear and concern, they send word throughout all of Israel asking for help. And Saul hears what's going on. And Saul, in his first great act of his role as king, gathers an army of men, and he goes down and defeats the enemy that is surrounding the city of Jabesh-Gilead, and he delivers the entire city of men. So I don't think these men ever forgot Saul. He did a wonderful thing for them. And that story back in chapter 11, it's a heroic deed by Saul. There's nothing compromising about it. There's nothing dishonorable about it. There's nothing unrighteous about it. It's a wonderful thing that he did in one of his true early great acts as king. These men never forgot, and so they're now, in a sense, returning the favor to Saul even after Saul's death. and they go out at a great at the cost of great personal sacrifice, at the cost of the danger to their own lives. They treat the body of the king honorably in memory of the fallen king. And then we see the events of 2 Samuel chapter 1 unfold from there. Let's read at least the first section of this. We'll see where how far we get in our time. Let me read starting in 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 1, and I'll read up through to just before David begins to sing his song, which he composed on the spot for the death of Saul and Jonathan. I'll read the first 16 verses. After the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained 2 days in Ziklag. And on the third day, behold, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. When he came to David, he fell to the ground and paid homage. David said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." David said to him, "How did it go? Tell me." And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead. And Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead." Then David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" The young man who told him said, "By chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on his spear. And behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me, and he called to me, and I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' And I answered him, 'I am an Amalekite.' And he said to me, 'Stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers.' So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my Lord." Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son, and for the people of the Lord, and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. And David said to the young man who told him, "Where do you come from?" And he answered, "I am the son of a sojourner, an Amalekite." David said to him, "How is it you were not afraid to put out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Then David called one of the young men and said, "Go and execute him." And he struck him down so that he died. And David said to him, "Your blood be on your head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" All right, we have here David, who is separated from the battle. He's been in Ziklag, as I mentioned earlier. The first thing we need to see is just in that circumstance, the Lord's sovereign blessing and his providential ordering of events. I mentioned this briefly in our study one or two studies ago, that what would have happened had David been with Saul during this battle? Remember, there have been many times since during this period of time when Saul has been pursuing David, that David longed to be restored to right relationship with Saul. It wasn't that David hated Saul. David loved Saul. David wanted to serve Saul. David wanted to be by his side. But Saul, in his rebellion and in the wicked developments of his heart, began to hate David and suspect him and saw him as a competitor to his own throne, to his own role as king. And Saul, for that reason, was attempting to kill David. But what would have happened if David's desire to be restored to Saul had been fulfilled by the Lord before this moment? David would have been by Saul's side in this battle, and one of two things would have happened, and neither one would have been good, and neither one would have served the Lord's purpose. One is, if David had been with Saul, because David was in right relationship with the Lord, and because David's life was the target of God's great blessing, the children of Israel would have won the battle. David's presence would have turned the tide and caused Israel to be victorious. But it was necessary, though tragic, that Israel would be defeated and be experiencing the judgment of the Lord. Because of their own heart's rebellion in following a rebellious king, for the years that they have been following him. And of course, God's judgment had to fall upon the king and had to fall upon the nation. And so God separated David from that event. The other eventuality or the other possibility would be if David was by Saul's side, what else could have happened? David would have participated and shared in the judgment that Saul experienced. David would have been killed alongside Saul. And of course, God has greater plans for David. So what we see here is just God's providence, God's sovereign hand to disconnect and separate these two men because he has separate plans for both of them. One to be blessed, one to be judged. And so David here is in Ziklag, but he receives this unexpected visitor, this young Amalekite. And what's interesting is the Amalekite tells the story of Saul's death, and does it confirm the earlier story of Saul's death that we saw in chapter 31? No, there's some similarities in that we see Saul, you know, near the point of death, and Saul seeking death. In the Amalekite story, he asks the Amalekite to kill him, but of course the Amalekite is not his armor bearer. In the earlier story, we saw Saul requesting from his armor bearer to be killed by the armor bearer. The armor bearer fearing greatly and refusing. Here in this story, the Amalekite is asked by Saul to kill him, and the Amalekite does not fear to kill him. And according to his story, according to his testimony, he actually does kill Saul at Saul's request, then takes the crown and the armlet on his arm, which are the symbolic indicators of his royal position, and he brings those as proof to David. Why would the Amalekite have come to David? Out of all of the cities in Israel that he could have come to, out of all the people in Israel he could have come to. Because it was well known that David had been anointed to be the future king. This is why Saul had been pursuing David for these number of years. So the Amalekite comes to David fully expecting to be the bearer of good news. He expects that when he brings this news to David, David's going to celebrate and rejoice at the news of Saul's death and is going to personally thank him and most likely generously reward him for having been the one that delivered him from his pursuer Saul by killing Saul. It's like, David, I've got good news for you. The man that's been trying to kill you all this time, don't worry about him. I took care of him. Now, where's my reward? It's kind of like that kind of a picture. And of course, the Amalekite is surprised, caught off guard, because David does not rejoice in the news of the death of Saul. David actually laments and grieves over the death of Saul. But before we get to David's response, let's talk for just a moment about the difference between these two accounts. We have the first account of Saul's death in chapter 31, in which Saul requests death by the armor bearer. The armor bearer fears, the armor bearer refuses. And then we have in chapter 1 of 2 Samuel a completely different account, in which the Amalekite says, I'm the one that killed Saul by Saul's request. Why the difference in the two accounts? Which is the correct and accurate and true account? And what's the explanation for the difference in the accounts? Well, let me just short form it for us. Chapter 31 is the correct and accurate historical account. It's what actually happened. How can we know that for sure? Because in the Amalekite's account, we just have his story. What we have in chapter 31 is the writer of the book of 1 Samuel telling us what actually happened as narrator of the story under the inspiration of the Spirit of God. So we can know with 100% certainty that the account in chapter 31 is what really happened. The differences in 2 Samuel tell us what story the Amalekite dreamed up in order to gain a reward from David, with his expectation of being welcomed by David with good news, rather than treated as he was, which is executed for daring to kill Saul the Lord's anointed. Well, what part of the Amalekite story can we say is accurate and true? Right, he was actually there because he brought physical evidence that he was at the site of where Saul died. He was on Mount Gilboa. Why was he there? He's not a Philistine. It's a battle between Israelites and Philistines. He's not an Israelite. He's not a Philistine. What's he doing at the battle? He says, I just happened on Mount Gilboa. Most likely not. What was a common thing in the ancient world was scavengers after a major battle. Whenever there was a major battle, people from all, you know, these are not righteous people, good people, but people from all of the surrounding area, whenever they knew a battle was taking place, would gather and wait for the battle to end. And they would go and strip the soldiers of anything of value, their weapons, their armor, anything that looked like it was worth their time to take and to steal off of the dead bodies. Most likely the Amalekite was waiting there, had seen that this was Saul, and as soon as Saul dies, and, you know, it's only Saul and his armor bearer on the mountaintop, as soon as Saul falls in his sword, what does the armor bearer do? He turns around, falls on his sword. It's just two men on the top of a mountain. And, you know, the Philistines had left. They've gone home for the night. They don't come back to strip the bodies until the next day. And so the Amalekite takes the crown of Saul. He takes the armlet off of his arm. And he concocts this story. And he concocts this plan to go and find David, to bring him these items symbolizing kingship, to basically say, David, I know you're going to be the next king now. Now please be generous in rewarding me for having taken out your enemy that's been pursuing you. So he's lying, and the truth of the matter is he didn't actually kill Saul at all. Saul did kill himself. He did commit suicide. And this man just came upon him after his death. And yet, he ends up being executed for killing Saul. So the question we have to resolve is, did David do an unrighteous thing in executing the Amalekite? Absolutely not. Number one, the Amalekite was clearly a liar. Number two, according to his own story, he was willing to portray himself to David in his lying account as the killer of the king of Israel. And just based upon his lie, he deserved the judgment of the Lord. Because if you're going to tell a story, if you're going to tell an account like this, at least tell it in a righteous way so that you come across as being a righteous person. Don't tell a story that portrays you as even worse in the eyes of the person that you're lying to. Now, I'm not here telling you guys go out and concoct, you know, believable lies to your own advantage. But that's, you know, that's really what's going on here. And so when David judges him, when David, you know, carries out the justice of the Lord in this man's life, and that's what it really is, he is convicted for daring in his story to not be afraid of killing the Lord's anointed. He should have never dared to kill the king of Israel, even if the king of Israel was requesting that of him, just like Saul's armor bearer refused to kill the king of Israel. And so he carries out the justice of the Lord. And then what we also see, of course, is how David in his heart responds to this news. What the lesson here for us is, and I think this is an important one for us all to catch, and I'll end with this, and what we'll do, we won't get to the song in the very last portion of chapter 1 this morning. I'll save that for the beginning of our next study. Is David, when he receives this news, not even for a moment, not even to a small degree, he doesn't say to himself, oh, good, finally, Saul's been chasing me for years. I've lost my home. And this is true for David. He lost his home. He lost his marriage to Saul's daughter. He lost his position in the kingdom. And it was not a small position. It was not a light position. He was the commander of the army of Israel. He was like the 4-star general of Israel's army, second in command only to Saul himself. He lost all of that, his home, his wife, his career, his position, his honor. He lost all of those things, and for the last several years, he's been hiding out in caves in the wilderness to escape from Saul's insane wrath. And he had every reason on a horizontal, natural level to be happy, or at least relieved, that Saul was finally out of the picture. And Saul was no longer trying to kill him. Instead, how does David respond? He deeply, really, not putting on a face for public purposes, from his soul mourns the death of Saul. He's truly sad that this man has died. What this teaches us about David, and this is why the Bible in another place identifies David as a man after God's own heart. Meaning this man is living his life with a higher spiritual perspective. He's not looking at the circumstances of his life based upon what's best for me in my personal circumstances. He's looking at this at the highest level of what's best for the name of the Lord. What's best for the kingdom of God on earth, the kingdom of Israel. And this death of the king of Israel, who he calls once again here in chapter 1, the Lord's anointed. These are David's words describing Saul. And he recognizes the death of the Lord's anointed is never a good thing, especially under such tragic circumstances. This isn't Saul dying in his bed at peace, an old man filled with the blessing of the Lord, and passing on his mantle to the next king. This is Saul being judged by the Lord in his last moments in life, and all of Israel suffering, and all of the name of the Lord suffering as a result. So David responds with a kingdom perspective, I'm concerned first and foremost of the name of the Lord perspective. And he mourns, and he's sad. And at the end of the chapter, we'll again save it for next time, but he writes a song of lament, which is a spiritual worship song. It's really oriented to the Lord, but it's describing the events of Saul's death and Jonathan's death as well from the perspective of what was lost. And this reference to Saul as being the Lord's anointed, I want to end with that this morning and say that this is particularly significant in light of what we just studied last Sunday as we're working our way through the list of the names of the Lord in Scripture. We've come to our study of the New Testament names of the Lord, and we were studying the name Christ, Messiah, this last Sunday. We saw that in this special role, this special name that's assigned to Jesus and belongs properly only to him, he is identified as the Lord's anointed, but we saw that the anointing role, the role of the anointed one, really emphasizes three subcategories of special roles that are portrayed symbolically throughout the Old Testament. You remember what those three roles are that are encompassed in this one great role of Jesus as the anointed one, the Christ, the Messiah. Those roles in the Old Testament were the roles of prophet, priest, and king. When David refers to Saul as the Lord's anointed, spiritually what he's identifying for us again is that Saul, in his role as king, was meant to live out his office as king of Israel as a symbol of Christ himself. And he does die, and Christ died. But what's the difference between the death of Saul and the death of Christ? Christ's death was his ultimate victory and his ultimate moment of honor. Saul's death is an ultimate defeat, an ultimate dishonor and rebellion and disobedience to God who placed him in that role as the anointed one. And so that's the greatest tragedy of this, is that Saul, out of all of the men in history, at that moment in history, was given the special privilege of portraying Christ to the world in this role as the Lord's anointed king. And he failed miserably. And he reversed the picture completely. It's like he took a picture of Christ and just tore it into pieces and ruined it in the way that he lived out his office. And that's what David's lamenting about. It's not just the death of a man. It's the death of what that man was given by the high calling of God to represent in the world and to an unbelieving world and to the believing covenant community. And he failed in that. And so David, who is going to be given the high calling and privilege to replace Saul and to fulfill as the anointed king what Saul never was able to accomplish and fulfill, nevertheless sees the value and the importance and the significance of that and mourns, because that was lost to Israel. And that was lost to all that would view those events at that time. All right, we'll put an end there. And next time we will start as David begins to sing his song of lament, starting in chapter 17, or chapter 1, verse 17.